Good afternoon, everyone, and also to our listeners online, if there are still any. Thank you for your resilience to stay with us up to this late hour. I'm going to talk to you about adaptive mediation, and I'm focusing in on mediation because it's kind of a microcosm of what we're talking about when we talk more broadly about peace processes. And so I think, although I'm going to focus in on mediation, I hope that you can scale it in your minds also when we talk about peace processes more broadly. And of course, I want to link it to our question, which is about who builds peace. And I think when we talk about who builds peace, it's of course, for me, an important, and many people have mentioned it today, that it's really about striking the right balance between those who are affected by conflict and those who are there to help those affected by conflict to deal with the conflict that they're engaging with. And this is not black and white. This is obviously a spectrum with very many different actors and levels on that spectrum. We spoke today about, I think Jean-Paul Manson used the words entangled, embedded. If we think about these relationships that we are talking about between those who are affected by conflict and those who are helping in one or other way. We can also think in terms of scales or circuits. And this is where I think another issue that came up a couple of times today is important, is the fact that although we may be focusing, for instance, in dealing with a particular conflict with a community affected by that conflict, they are of course not able to, at that level, bring about change at other levels. So maybe at the regional, national, international level, although there are things happening at those level that have an influence on the local conflict, right? So as peace builders, especially, that can move between these different levels or that are located at different levels. So for instance, someone like Jonathan, who's sitting in London, dealing with somebody in a field office, who's dealing with somebody in a local community, that kind of organization can work at all these different levels. And I think one of the most important thing we as international peace builders can do is to first of all deal with peace building in our jurisdiction, at our level. Look at, we may not have a lot of leverage or influence about what's happening in a local community where we are maybe trying to help, but certainly we should have much more influence and leverage in our own communities where we are located in terms of reducing harm that our communities could be causing in these local communities that we're working with. One thing I want to maybe preface also my discussion on adaptive mediation about is that when we talk about mediation, I think we can distinguish between many different types of mediation. Ukraine is very much, for instance, at the front of our minds at the moment. And if we think about mediation in a conflict situation like Ukraine, it is about trying to bring an end to the conflict, trying to bring an end to the suffering, using a very broad range of tools. And it's about dealing with some parties, typically in that kind of conflict situation, that still believe they can achieve more through violence than through peace. And that's a very different mediation than a mediation where you're engaging with parties that have reached a point of ripeness where they recognize what Zahrtmann calls a mutual hurting stalemate, or where they recognize that they can't achieve their objectives through violence. They have to switch to seeking a mediated solution. So a lot of what I want to say now about adaptive mediation is really about that second type of mediation setting, because there our goal is to find a self-sustainable peace, not to bring an end to the conflict using any means of leverage that we can. And it speaks a little bit perhaps to the difference between negative peace and positive peace that we also mentioned at various times during our discussion today. And maybe the one thing I would like to say there is that I think we sometimes, I think it's very useful concepts, but we sometimes think of them too much as a kind of a chronological dimension. I think Jean-Paul also mentioned this morning that these things are happening at the same time. And I think especially when you think about sustaining a negative peace, that is impossible to do without many elements of positive peace being present. So I think these two are more closely interlinked than we often think of. Of course, it's interesting from a kind of analytical perspective to try to make that distinction. But the core puzzle I want to share with you and discuss with you when I talk about adaptive mediation is that over the last few decades, you know, our attempt to professionalize mediation, I think, have had a number of side effects or negative unintended consequences. One of them is that our focus has shifted from a occupation with the conflict and the people involved, the parties to the conflict, to the mediator, to mediation, to peace agreements. We have created a lot of expectations of what we think mediators should achieve, what a peace agreement should contain, the ethics that mediators should bring to the mediation table. And I think the result is that many of the peace agreements that have been adopted, or many of the actions that we take when it comes to how we engage with peace processes, if I make it a bit more broader, reflects more what our expectations are of peace than what they say about the local context or the interests of the parties to the conflict. I think in many cases, mediators and their teams have had so much influence over the process and the content of the agreements reached that the parties to the conflict and the people affected by the conflict don't recognize themselves and their experiences and concerns in the content of the agreement or the content of the process. And of course, as a result, many of the peace agreements adopted or agreed to in these kind of contexts collapse soon after they've been adopted. And that is why I've had this interest to really try to understand and think about how can we make these peace agreements, or then more broader, these peace processes more sustainable, more self-sustainable. Self-sustainable meaning that they are sustained, implemented, maintained, further developed by the people involved in the conflict, not as a result of external or international influence or support or encouragement. And this brings me to this concept of adaptive mediation, which is a specific approach to mediation that is based on a recognition that the social systems that we are trying to influence through mediation or broader peace processes are complex. In other words, they are emergent, they are dynamic, they are nonlinear, and therefore they are inherently uncertain and unpredictable. Ufra mentioned this morning going to the moon, so I want to use this distinction between something that is complicated and something that is complex by referring to traveling to space. I think we all think that we have this kind of common reference that we make that if we want to say that what we are doing is not very difficult, we're saying it's not rocket science. Right? Rocket science is very complicated. You need a lot of different types of knowledge to design spaceships, to design how they should be launched and their velocities, et cetera, et cetera. But once you've been able to perfect that, you can do that over and over again. In fact, I think the rocket that has been used most up to now to send people into space is the Soyuz rockets that's essentially been unchanged in design since the 1960s. That's complicated. It's difficult, but it's complicated. Complex, like social systems, mean that we, for instance, like we heard today, we have something like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission or the National Peace Accords that's worked relatively well in a place like South Africa. but we cannot replicate it anywhere else necessarily. We cannot even replicate it in South Africa today in a because of the different context that it's in, right? So this unpredictability, uncertainty, and irreproducibility are inherent characteristics of complex systems. And that's why peace is so much more difficult to deal with. So next time people belittle our work and say it's not rocket science, you can go back and tell them our work is much more complex than rocket science. So this recognition of complexity, I think, has a number of implications for how we approach our work in peace processes then, but also then especially how we deal with mediation. And I'll focus in on three implications. Firstly, this uncertainty and unpredictability mean that we cannot use a deductive theory of change when we try to influence social systems or social change processes. What I mean with that is, because we cannot predict what's going to happen, we cannot design a theory of change with linear step-by-step chronological interventions, which with any certainty is going to produce the result that we intended to have. And this is how, I'll use Graham's 90%, this is how 90% of our peace processes are designed, right? Because when we apply for money, we are forced to come up with a theory of change that shows the funder that we have a high degree and convince the funder that if we take the following steps, we're going to have the following results. I would say that to cope with complexity, we need to use an inductive approach, which basically means that we don't know what's going to work, so we need to try a variety of things. When we try a variety of things, you could call it experimentation, if you like, or exploration of different interventions. We need to track those very closely and see which effects they have, which means we need a very relatively short iterative cycle of reflection. I've been part of a team that designed a performance assessment system for UN peacekeeping operations, and they use a 4-month cycle to do this kind of reflective process, right? So you need to judge which of those interventions or steps or actions that you are taking is having the kind of desired effect that you want to have and which ones are not. And you have to stop doing those that are not working and maybe expand and work more, bring in more diversity and those that seem to have the desired effect. And one thing that's important to remember in this context is that something that may be working today and tomorrow is most likely not going to work next week or next month, because the systems we are engaging with is proactive, conscious human beings that are constantly reacting to how we are engaging with the social system. And if what we are doing is having a certain effect that for which there will be winners and losers, because we are trying to change, bring about certain change in that society, people will react and find ways to circumvent or go around or find different ways to do what they would like to do. And therefore, even those things that we've come up with in our interventions that seem to work, we need to keep monitoring, because we will need to keep diversifying and keep evolving those as well as we go along. And that's also why it's important when we talk about peace agreements to think and understand that a self-sustainable peace agreement is also an evolving peace agreement, or something at least that can manage during its implementation process with a changing and continuous evolving situation. So that's where the adaptiveness and adaptive mediation and adaptive peace comes from. This need to continuously attempt to explore different interventions, monitor them very closely, reflect on how they're doing, introducing new adaptations, understanding that this is a continuous iterative cycle that will never stop. We're not going to arrive at some point with the solution. We need to continuously co-evolve with the changing situation as we go along. So the second implication I want to talk about of complexity and predictability for mediation processes has to do with the ownership of the peace agreement. When we were thinking that as experts, we had this knowledge about peace and peace building that we could bring to communities affected by conflict, meant that we had some kind of a privileged experience and knowledge that we could teach or lead communities in process. But if we recognize the social complexity of what we're working with, and we recognize that there isn't a way of predetermining exactly what process will work or what the outcome will be, I think this shows us that the value and the role of the communities we're working with in terms of the knowledge that they have is at least equal to the role that international contributors to peace may or may not have, right? So to think much more in terms of breaking down this hierarchy or inequality between international peace builders or external peace builders, people who have peace building as a profession, and the local communities we are engaging with. But there's another, I would say, even more important reason to think about the local ownership and the involvement of local communities. And that is that because the process of the content of what we're dealing with when we come and engaging with peace processes or mediation processes have to be context specific, have to relate to the culture and history and realities and interests of the people involved in the conflict, it has to emerge from the process, from themselves. It can be an engagement, and there, of course, a role that mediators and external actors play. Jonathan, I think, spoke very eloquently about the various different contributions that external peace builders or mediators can bring to a process and the limitations that communities or people affected by conflict may have in terms of their ability to perhaps overcome some of their challenges and so forth. But taking all of that into account, we are not going to arrive at a self-sustainable peace process if the content of that peace process or peace agreement has not been generated by the people engaged in the process. If the content comes from the mediators, then we will see the kind of relapse in peace agreements that we've seen before. So that is a critical element if we want to achieve self-sustainable peace agreements or peace processes. Lastly, the role of the mediator has to, because of this importance of the parties affected by the conflict, the parties to the mediation, because of their importance in the process, the last thing I want to emphasize is then the role of the mediator. What is the appropriate role of the mediator or the peace builder? I would say that it's important that role should be limited to process facilitation. And it's difficult to put a hard line on it. Of course, that needs interpretation in different situations. But what I would try to say is that mediators, peace builders should stop short of providing content. Content needs to come. The process can come from the mediators, but content needs to come from the local context, from the engagement, from a self-emerging process of the engagement of the local actors or the parties to a mediation. So adaptive mediation is thus a specific approach to mediation designed to cope with the complexity and to generate peace processes and peace agreements that are locally grounded and self-sustainable. That to me is the essence of what I'm trying to convey when I talk about adaptive mediation or adaptive peace processes. How am I doing on time? Okay, I'll just wrap up in there. So one thing is, I know when I talk about it in the way that I spoke to you about it now, it could sound quite theoretical. But I want to bring it down to a practical example. I think one example we heard today that really inspired me in this process as well is the National Peace Accord and the kind of infrastructures for peace that came out of this African experience that Liz told us about earlier today. That was, of course, not designed as an adaptive process, but I think in reality, it really shows the content of the of the type of process that I'm describing. Because here you had at the local community, on a continuous basis, key actors from the local community coming together, whether it's religious leaders, mayors of town, community leaders, the head of the police, the army if they were around, and other all kinds of other community leaders that came together on a continuous basis to either respond to a particular challenge that has emerged from the community, or that as discussing the fault lines that they may see and try to prevent future disputes from arising in their communities. And this is something that is happening iteratively all the time, and that is something happening all the country and then generating information up to the regional and national levels. And so for me, that's a very practical example of a process that is very iterative, that is learning, that is trying different ways of managing this crisis that they are experiencing, and learning from that and bringing them forward to the next iteration, the lessons learned from the previous experience. So that's maybe one of the examples you can keep in your mind when you think about how this kind of adaptive peace, adaptive mediation process can be imagined in our everyday world. Let me stop there. Thank you very much.